This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Parents who spend too much time on their smartphones or other technology in the presence of their children risk stunting their kids' social and emotional development.
You don't have to be addicted to your phone for the phone or other devices to start to intrude upon or interrupt your interactions with others.
Eric Stock talks to ISU professor Brandon McDaniel about his research into technoference. We'll also hear from former president of ISU, Al Bowman, about what he sees in the latest up and down enrollment numbers from Illinois' public universities, and get to know Joshua Johnson, the host of GLT's newest show, 1A. After a GLT news update, it's Monday, September 24th, the first day of our fall GLT Fun Drive. And this is Sound Ideas.
Thank you for choosing this GLT podcast. And while it's free to you, it's not free to produce. Please take a moment and make a contribution to pay for this program. Go to WGLT.org. And thank you.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. For years, Illinois' public universities have been bleeding students, poached by out-of-state schools eager to capitalize on uncertainty about the future of higher education here in Illinois. Now, more than a year after that historic budget standoff ended, Illinois Board of Higher Education Executive Director Al Bowman sees that out-migration as a double-edged sword. He told me he sees good news and some not-so-good news in this fall's hot-off-the-presses enrollment numbers.
The not-so-good news is that the enrollment declines have continued, but they have slowed. The overall decline across public universities for this fall is about a 1% decrease compared to last year. Last year it was 2%. So the fact that the decline is slowing is a positive. There are a couple of institutions that saw pretty healthy increases. Eastern Illinois University, on a percentage basis, had a nice, healthy increase in its freshman class. Two of the U of I campuses, the Urbana campus and U of I Chicago Circle, both saw pretty significant increases. One of the positives, though, is that graduate enrollment has remained relatively stable from a year ago. Nationally, there have been some pretty significant declines in graduate enrollment, reflecting the sort of the international situation with immigration rhetoric out of Washington.
Well, you mentioned Eastern Illinois University. Eastern's had a tough run. They've seen declining student enrollment. I think they've lost almost a third of their student body in the last 5 years alone. But as you mentioned, this fall, a bit of good news with the freshman class up 25%, total enrollment up 7%. So what do you make of what happened at Eastern?
In talking to their president and their admissions people, it sounds like they really took a long, hard look at branding, at their marketing efforts, and they retooled, and they did some things that I think allowed them to direct their resources at their core population, and it worked. And, you know, as I look around the country, there have been a number of institutions that have done a similar kind of transformation, and there are two in the city of Detroit, Michigan, that have done this: Wayne State University and a small private school called Detroit Mercy. Both had significant enrollment challenges, and through a more intense recruitment effort, more targeted recruitment strategies, they both turned around their enrollment fortunes, and they're on the mend. And, you know, if it can be done in challenging places like Detroit, in rural places like Charleston, Illinois, I think with the right approach, it can be done.
Well, what were the most concerning numbers to you?
Well, we had three institutions with double-digit decreases: Western Illinois University, Southern Illinois Carbondale, and Northeastern Illinois University in Chicago. Those are pretty large decreases. We we were expecting not so good news out of Southern Carbondale and Western. We knew that that their freshman application pool was smaller than it had been, so there's obviously still more work to do there. A little surprised by what happened at Northeastern. You know, it's an urban school, you know, certainly has a population base around it. I don't think it'll be that difficult for them to turn it around there, simply because of the fact that they're in an area with just lots and lots of students.
So are schools having any success keeping in-state students from leaving Illinois? What are you hearing about this year's freshman class as it relates to out-migration?
We don't know the out-migration numbers yet for this fall. Looking at last year's numbers, of course, it was up pretty significantly. I would be surprised if it was very different from last year. Now, certainly some institutions individually have been able to hold their own and, in some cases, produce pretty healthy gains. One of the stories without migration that we don't talk very much about is the number of students who come into the state. And when you compare the number that came into the state last year with, go back to the year 2000, there are actually more students migrating into Illinois today than there was back in the year 2000. You know, it's the out-migration, of course, that we're all concerned with. Out-migration, I don't know, in my mind, is a bit of a double-edged sword because I think one of the positives is that it has gotten the attention of leaders in Springfield, and it's gotten their attention in a way that that higher ed wasn't able to do. It's sort of obvious, tangible evidence that that there are some significant challenges facing higher ed, and if we don't address them as a state, we will suffer the consequences.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm here with Al Bowman, the former president of Illinois State University. He's now executive director of the Illinois Board of Higher Education. Dr. Bowman, we've all heard about this decline in the number of high schoolers and what that might mean for future college enrollment. And soon we'll have the children of the Great Recession, too, might also be a lower number. What generational shifts are Illinois universities needing to watch?
Well, there are certainly some headwinds that we're pushing against right now, and they will intensify in the future. One of the major ones is the shift in the demographic outlook or makeup of the high school pipeline. And that high school pipeline will have more students who are first-generation college students and more students whose families have low incomes. When you look at the percentage of students in our K-12 system who are qualify for free or reduced lunch, that kind of tells you what that future college generation is going to look like. Certainly, we're expecting around 2025 to see a pretty steep decline in the number of high school graduates. And of course, you know, with an aging population, it produces different pressures on state budgets and lots of pressure on Medicaid spending. A lot of the dollars that have been shifted away from higher ed, and this is not only true in Illinois but across the country, a lot of those dollars have gone to support Medicaid costs, which have skyrocketed. And I don't think states have made a conscious decision to defund higher ed. I think they have only so many dollars. And so the shift to a tuition-based funding model has occurred not only in Illinois but across the country. A tuition-dependent business model can work, but it only works if an institution has stable enrollment. And so one of the reasons that Illinois State University has been able to weather this storm, particularly during the budget impasse, is that the institution maintained solid enrollment. And that provided the tuition revenue that it needed when the state wasn't providing appropriations.
So we've heard from State Representative Dan Brady that the bipartisan higher education working group that he's part of is now sort of pivoting to begin work on a new funding formula for higher education. It would be similar in scope to the K-12 funding formula rewrite that happened just last year. So are you part of these discussions as well? Can you kind
Absolutely.
Of update us on where things stand?
We've been talking about this pretty intensely for the last 6 months. And we have a formal working group made up of people from the staff at IBHE, also representatives from each of the universities, governor's office, and the General Assembly. And that group is currently working through all the challenges associated with putting together a formula that that everyone will be comfortable with. We have a performance funding formula right now. The General Assembly wants us to produce an overall funding formula that they could use that would help them. It would basically be allow them to have recommendations for how dollars would be distributed across the campuses in the state. Right now, for this week and the next couple of weeks, the group is focusing on a literature review, looking at what's been done in other states, what's worked, what hasn't worked, and our goal is to finish this work, at least have the first iteration of a formula ready to go by April 1st. And I think we'll get there.
How are public universities funded now? How does that work?
Yeah, the way it works today is that the dollars are distributed really based on a historical pattern. And so Illinois State University, for example, has a base budget. And that budget gets adjusted upward or downward based on a percentage increase year in and year out. And then there's a carve-out of 0.5% that would go to performance funding based on things like enrollment, graduation rates, retention rates. The performance part of the current distribution is so small that it really doesn't have an impact on institutional behavior. And so one of the struggles that the group is wrestling with is, what percentage of state dollars should be allocated to performance? And to what degree do you go down that path when your overall base is roughly 49% of what it was back in 2002? And while I'm glad we're working on a performance or on a funding formula, I think it's very important. The reality is that no matter how good the formula is, it won't change the fact that universities have far fewer state dollars to spend today than they had 16 years ago. Hmm. And fundamentally, that has to change, or we're not going to see much in the way of results.
Well, what's your sense of where the appetite is in the legislature for going more toward performance-based funding? If it's at 0.5% now, do you sense that there's an appetite to go significantly in that direction?
I'm not sure how far they want to go, but they certainly want to go to a degree that it would get the attention of the institutions and drive institutional behavior, and I think that's good. I think one of the positives that has occurred in Springfield is that because of the out-migration, there's a realization that the cuts have really been detrimental to the institutions. And, to varying degrees, Illinois State University has managed to actually make progress during the last 16 years. That's certainly true of a number of other institutions, but not true of all of them. My sense in talking to the governor and to the four legislative leaders is that they all realize that more dollars need to go into higher ed. Now, there's certainly debate about where those dollars should go. Should it go in the form of aid directly to students? Should it go to institutions for operations? That remains to be seen. There's also a realization that that the capital needs of higher ed have not been met over the years. And, our fine arts building on this campus is a good example of a building that needed to be rehabbed, two decades ago. As the state's economy recovers, it will slowly begin to have the resources to address some of these longstanding problems. I'm encouraged by the fact that in July, the first month of the fiscal year, state revenues were up over $340 million. In August, they were up about another $180 million. If we can sustain that kind of growth throughout the fiscal year, that will begin to allow the state to recover from the downturn. But it's going to take a while. There is no way we can turn this around in 2 or 3 years. I mean, it literally will take a decade or more.
That's Al Bowman, Executive Director of the Illinois Board of Higher Education, who was previously president at Illinois State University. You can take a closer look at enrollment numbers for Illinois' public universities with an interactive graphic on our website, wglt.org. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from the Normal Theater, presenting Grammy-winning, multi-platinum solo pianist George Winston on Thursday, October 11th at 7:30. Winston will perform a variety of music, including Vince Guaraldi's Peanuts pieces. Details and tickets at normaltheater.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Coming up in a bit, a story I'm dreading a little bit myself as the father of two little ones, an ISU professor who's researching the impact our smartphone behaviors have on the development of our children. But first, more and more jails and courthouses in Illinois are turning to video court proceedings to save money and time. But as Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gaines reports, some question whether the rights of the accused are being trampled in the process.
Now, if we were taking an inmate to court, this is the walk that we would have to take.
I'm walking with Sheriff Jeff Standard of Fulton County. It's a rural area in west central Illinois. His deputies used to have to walk inmates to the courthouse half a block away for their first court appearances.
They would have shackles on, so their steps are going to be half of what we're taking, and their belts are going to be chained together. So you're walking in a line. It's kind of like a three-legged race.
Standard says that changed about 5 years ago when the county got its video court system. For first appearances, inmates now stand in a small room inside the jail and talk to the judge through a camera. Standard says the video system saves Fulton County money and makes it safer for everyone.
Now we can take them right in the back, put them in front of the video camera. The judge has access to their video camera, and they're having a conversation just like we are now, but it's just over a video screen.
But Charles Davidson says that's not what it was like for him. Davidson is a 68-year-old youth mentor. He was in and out of Champaign County Jail for a period of 20 years, mostly for charges stemming from a heroin addiction.
When I first went to the video court, it just blew my mind because I'm watching everybody get up and go in front of the screen, and it's either yes, sir, or no, sir. You know, you couldn't say anything.
There's limited research available on the use of video court, but what's out there shows the practice is growing. In a national 2009 survey from the Pretrial Justice Institute, more than half the counties surveyed said they use video conferencing for first appearances. Davidson says the first time he experienced video court was for a hearing on a charge he says he wasn't guilty of. The police had accused him of giving them the wrong last name. He says he just gave them his first name. During video court,
I was trying to explain to the judge what happened, and they told me to be quiet and talk to my attorney. So I went to continue to talk, and then the CO that was there said if I keep talking, it was going to be a contempt of court. So I shut up.
Davidson says he couldn't talk to the judge during video court the way he could have in person. He ended up pleading guilty to that charge and was sentenced to 18 months in prison. Locke Bowman is a law professor at Northwestern University. He sued the chief judge of Cook County in 2006 over the use of video court. He says it's a
practice that dehumanizes the arrested person.
Bowman says it's especially disturbing when used for bond hearings. This is a key moment. It's when a judge decides whether someone can go free during their criminal proceedings or stay locked up.
Any of us would want to be physically present with the person making the decision. decision as opposed to just being an image on a video screen.
Bowman says the judge he sued voluntarily stopped using the video system and they've never resumed in Cook County. I told Champaign County Circuit Judge Jeffrey Ford about Bowman's concerns and he said,
I'm not too sure exactly where he's coming from.
Ford says if you make sure you're not violating anyone's due process, video court is good for everyone, including the incarcerated.
If you do it right, it doesn't diminish their rights. Things will be done quicker, and their case may move along faster.
Davidson, the formerly incarcerated person, says he could see a potential benefit to video court, too.
That's better than going outside and everybody look at me walk down the street in overalls, chained up, you know. You know, I hated that, too, now.
If someone had asked him what he thought about video court before he actually experienced it, he might have thought it was an okay idea, but...
I probably would have thought that we was going to still be able to talk to the judge. We weren't going to be silenced, you know.
Davidson, the sheriff, and the judge I talked to all think video court is here to stay. And that wouldn't be so bad, Davidson says, if the people in power were more willing to listen to those whose lives it affects the most. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
Illinois Newsroom is a collaboration of public media newsrooms covering education, politics, health, and the environment. This is Sound Ideas. Sound Ideas. Some experts say black women may bear the brunt if union membership declines or financial support lessens as a result of the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Janus versus AFSCME. That ruling decreed that public sector unions can no longer force workers they represent to pay fees in lieu of union dues. But conservative groups say the cost is justified to protect workers' free speech rights. Maureen McKinney reports on this week's Illinois Issues in-depth story.
Mae Benjamin has heart trouble and other ailments. She relies on a personal assistant for basics like help in showering and housekeeping, even balancing a checkbook. The assistant is her daughter, Melody Benjamin. Melody says she, in turn, depends on her union, SEIU, for support. Some experts say it is African American women like Melody Benjamin who could feel the most impact of the Janus decision. The Supreme Court, acting on an Illinois-based case supported by Governor Bruce Rauner, made its ruling in June. Rauner's staff did not respond to a request for comment about the story. Already earned less on average. Black women make 66 cents for every dollar white men are paid, and studies show that they earn even less than white women. Nationwide, there are 17 million public service sector employees. Almost 18% of those are African American women. Economist Heidi Scherholz is with the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C.
To the extent that public sector union members act on their newfound ability to free ride to get the benefits of unionization without having to pay for the cost of those benefits, if that succeeds in hurting unions' effectiveness, that will have a disproportionate impact on black women.
Ralph Martiri is executive director of the Chicago-based Center on Tax and Budget Accountability, and he agrees. Both Martiri Center and the EPI have funders that include unions.
Taking away union protections, particularly public employee union protection, will disproportionately cause harm to African-American women just because of the large percentage of them that do, in fact, find not just gainful employment, but even leadership-based, management-based employment in the public sector.
A September report that looked at the state of unions estimates that the Janus decision will reduce public sector union membership rates by 8 percentage points. But Martiri said such numbers are only conjecture and that the Janus decision could have a different effect.
It could galvanize efforts of the union to get their base more excited about not just staying a member of the union, but recruiting others that are on the fence to get involved in the union to protect their rights. So we'll see if it has that kind of sort of motivating, organizing effect for union leaders. I'm sure they're going to try to use it.
The unions themselves are not reporting diminishing numbers so far. In mid-August, An AFSCME Council 31 spokesman said about a dozen members quit the union, while his organization had signed up an additional 1,000 or so. An Illinois Education Association spokeswoman said her members were invigorated by the anti-union rhetoric revolving around Janus. Since the decision, she said, less than 1% of the membership had resigned, but others were signing up at a rate of 3-1. Melanie Benjamin, the healthcare assistant, is part of the collective bargaining unit and is an executive committee member for her local.
We're going to get stronger, and we're going to just educate our members and educate our home care workers and let them know that they do have a voice and the work that we do is vital.
But conservative groups that supported the Janus argument, like the Policy Institute, say the struggle between them and unions is about First Amendment rights. The Policy Institute declined to comment on tape. Janus himself did not answer a request for comment. Jarrett Skorup is Director of Communications for the Michigan-based Mackinac Center for Public Policy. He says he doesn't believe that the Janus decision is a negative for African-American women.
From our standpoint, that just means that a higher percentage of African-American women are going to have a choice in their membership. So they bear the benefits of the decision, I would say, because they can choose whether they want to continue paying dues to the union or not.
Meanwhile, Benjamin says she refuses to be discouraged.
We're going to continue to face these attacks, but we're not going to allow them to push us down.
I'm Maureen McKinney.
You can read this full story right now at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas.
It's Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A. Think about why you choose GLT and NPR, and then choose to make a contribution. Now, maybe you choose public radio because you never want to stop learning, and you want to rely on the facts while you do. Whatever the reason, we are so grateful that you choose public radio. I hope you'll choose to join the thousands of other GLT listeners who support GLT financially. Make your first ever contribution or renew your support at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, a grant-making organization committed to helping you meet your philanthropic goals through donor advised funds, endowments, scholarships, and more. More information at ilprairiecf.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Parents who spend too much time on their smartphones or other technology in the presence of their children risk stunting their child's social and emotional development. That's according to research done by Brandon McDaniel, an assistant professor in Illinois State University's Department of Family and Consumer Sciences. McDaniel tells GLT's Eric Stock he decided to study that issue, what he calls technoference, after observing how smartphones were quickly becoming an obtrusive force in our lives.
So it really stems back to a long time ago, a galaxy far, far away. A long time ago, maybe in 2012 or a little bit before, I just began to see a lot of the changes that were starting to take place in terms of our interactions and the ways in which, because I was also on a college campus at that time, everyone kind of embedded, their faces embedded in their phones. I had lots of family friends and everything. I would watch them with their kids or with others and their interactions and just started to see a lot of this ways in which technology might have been getting in the way a little bit of some of the interactions they were having. And so then it really stemmed from that idea of where I originally saw that and started from there.
Well, you see this when you walk to work on campus every day, right?
Yeah. It's very enlightening to just look up and realize that you're the only one staring at nature.
So why is this a problem?
So what we find, if we go to some of my early work, so in 2012, we started looking at this. We called it technoference, this idea that technology, so it's combining two words, technology and interference. And it's this idea that, well, let me say it this way. Before this, a lot of people had started to focus on what they called problematic use or almost like mobile phone addiction. And really what I was trying to get at is that you don't have to be addicted to your phone for the phone or other devices to start to intrude upon or interrupt your interactions with others. We live in this ever-connected world. It's always with us all the time, and there's lots of different notifications and things that go off on that. So what happens is really we designed this term to be to kind of encompass even minor everyday interruptions and intrusions that might occur.
Give me an example of how this is impacting the household dynamic.
So a concrete example would be like, well, we see research out there where children, there's research out there by others where they've interviewed thousands of children. And even a Pew research report that just came out recently where they interviewed teenagers and others to figure out what they were feeling. And basically, a lot of the time, we see that they use a lot of emotion words like sad, angry, frustrated, depressed, lonely. This idea that they really are noticing what their parents are doing, and they start and they're beginning to feel like their parents think their phones are more important than them. And if you think about small children, especially, infants, toddlers, preschoolers, even up into the grade school years, they often don't have that cognitive capacity that we have as adults to be like, okay, I understand you still love me. You know, we're still friends, but you're checking your phone right now. I'm going to check mine. It's going to be okay. We're going to move on. But for a kid, all they see is over and over again, my parents are looking at their phone. They're not looking at me. They're not paying attention to me.
They need that connection.
And so like that's kind of an example I would give is often what children are seeing, if parents aren't careful, since we don't often pay attention to how many times we check our phones a day, they're often seeing us staring at our phones. They're really seeing the back of our phone.
And I guess parents don't realize this. They're perhaps turning to their phone for an escape from reality for a few minutes or even less than that, but they're compounding the problem, I guess.
Yeah, and that's actually what one of our recent studies finds is we looked at this longitudinally, so over time, and we found kind of this cycle where it doesn't matter where it starts. I'm a systems person, so let's not place blame on the parents or let's not place blame on the kids, but let's just start somewhere right now. So if the kid, let's say the kid is a kind of stressful kid, they react a lot, they're very emotionally reactive to things, and so it stresses the parent out. As the parent gets stressed, the parent's more likely to withdraw into technology or check their technology, maybe to calm down or for other reasons. And then as that happens, more of that technoference happens. It's getting in the way of the interactions with the child. So then what we see is that actually causes the child over time to react more negatively, to show what we call more behavior problems. And then that stresses the parent out even more, and we get stuck in this cycle over time if we're not careful.
How does a parent maintain this balancing act? Because they still are going to be on their phone to a certain degree, and perhaps they need to be to a certain degree. How do they find the right balance?
I think, and that's why I was saying, it's going to be different for every family. But I think we can still go back to some of the things that the American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended, that really we should be thinking about what are tech-free times or tech-free zones that we can set up inside of our homes, kind of like we're treating our homes or certain areas or times of our home as a sacred space, a space and a time where we will only interact and pay like complete attention to one another. So some examples, I think one really common example we often think about is like, oh, well, there's not going to be any phones at the dinner table. That might work for one family. Maybe that doesn't work for another family, but someone might set that up and that would be kind of like a tech-free time or a tech-free zone. Another family might decide, I'm not going to bring my device into my child's bedroom. And so that's kind of like a tech-free zone. There's no reason, they might be thinking, there's no reason for me to have my phone in here. And so we will only have our one-on-one, high-quality attention and time inside this room.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with Assistant Professor Brandon McDaniel of Illinois State University's Department of Family and Consumer Sciences. He's researching the impact of technology on couples and families. You say that adults reach for a device 70 times a day and not even realize it. That actually seems kind of low.
Yeah, the estimates range all over the place. So I'd say their estimates are like 70 to 140 or more times. So, yep, just depends on which estimate you look at.
I guess it's sort of a pet peeve when you're talking to someone and they pull out their phone, they start looking at it. Can you show an engagement when on a smartphone, even with an apparent lack of eye contact?
So for children, I would say a lack of eye contact is really impactful. And it's very difficult for them to realize that you're still paying attention to them at all. With adults, maybe you could do it a little bit. Overall, what we see, though, is it still has a, kind of a negative effect on the interactional quality. It's just not as high quality of an interaction that's taking place. And so if it happens a lot, it's a problem. If it's happening just sometimes, know, you're going to get over it and it's going to be fine.
Do you anticipate a cultural shift at any point as you hear more people say, you know, they're on Facebook all the time and they're depressed because of it? Do you see that ever changing, or is it just going to continue to spiral and worsen?
It seems like we're kind of hearing a little bit of a shift maybe from some. I mean, I guess I would like to say I like to take a more optimistic view overall. Although a lot of my research focuses on these negative things about phones and technology, I feel like over time, the human race has been pretty good at adapting to new technologies. Now, I still like to call these alarms because there's been casualties along the way every time. But
casualties are you referring to?
Oh, I'm just thinking about as a new technology is introduced, there's always potential addictions and other things that come along the way with that as people get too involved in the technology, too engrossed in it at the cost of their relationships. So really, if we look at some of the recent reports that are coming out from example, like the Pew Research report that just came out recently about teens and social media use, it seems like teens are starting to react to the fact and realizing that they're on it too much. And because of that, I'm a little hopeful that they may start to say, hey, you know what? I saw what it was like to have parents who were distracted by phones. You know, I saw what it was like to have friends who were distracted by phones. I know what it felt like to be on this all the time and comparing myself to others all the time. And I'm hopeful that many of those will react to that and begin to try to change how they use their phone and how they interact with others.
I guess it does start with each individual, because I may be annoyed at someone who seems disengaged while they're on their phone, but I know I've done that too. And I may think, well, I've got to take care of something that's really important. The other person may not necessarily be aware of that. They're thinking the same thing, that, hey, that's just being rude.
Mm-hmm. And that's where it comes down to communication. We've got to be, now that we have our phones, instead of whatever, I mean, think about parents. We used to have, yes, parents have been distracted, or we've all been distracted for a long, long time. But before, you could kind of see what people were distracted by or what they were doing, especially for children. They kind of had these context clues of like, oh, mom's getting out the phone book, or mom's, you know, turning the news on for this, or mom, you know, there are these context clues of, oh, okay, this is what's going on right now. Now all you see is the back of the phone. So if you're not communicating what is happening and why it might be important to happen right now at this moment, then that's, well, I would just say that's really what we need to do, is we need to communicate that to people. People need to understand why that needs to happen right now. And we also need to think carefully about whether it really does need to happen right now.
What are the long-term concerns of children who are raised by detached parents?
So there's a lot of concerns that come along with that. One of the things that, so being a developmental psychologist a bit by trade and expertise, I that is one thing I'm actually really concerned about, is we have something out there that's called attachment, this idea of how, and you want kids to have this kind of secure, warm, strong bond with their parents. And as they have that, we see lots of good outcomes, great academic success, they're more successful in life, their relationships are higher quality, their romantic relationships, their family relationships, they're better parents. So then I get concerned if I see a lot of this going on, because we don't have the research yet to show it, but it's where I think we're heading as a field, is we want to try to see, is this going to ultimately affect the kind or the type of attachment that children are forming with their parents? And I, unfortunately, I believe that it may be affecting that in a negative way. And if that happens, then there's a lot of potential negative outcomes that can kind of flow from that over time, not just for these individuals, but for society as a whole.
It's ISU's Brandon McDaniel with Eric Stock. McDaniel says he's not trying to blame parents. He has three young children himself, but he wants to sound the alarm that technology is one more thing they need to learn to manage for their child's development. This is Sound Ideas. Joshua Johnson has only been on the GLT airwaves for a few weeks as host of 1A, but his career as a journalist and broadcaster go back more than a decade. Johnson talks with GLT's Eric Stock about the concept behind 1A, the unique combination of broadcasters and performers who have influenced him, how public media in particular is especially vital today, and what he wants his audience to take away each day.
I think the main thing that we want listeners to take away is what they bring. I think the best thing about 1A is not that I am here, it's that you come here and that you share what you know, your stories, your insights, your experiences, your questions, your concerns, your hopes, even your fears and your irritations, and that that makes for a rich national conversation. We're trying to make 1A what we think of as a national mirror. We're trying to hold that image up to the nation so we can see ourselves more clearly and decide what it is we want to be. And the best thing about the program would be if you contributed to 1A, if you helped to clean that national mirror up, to shine it up, to clarify it so that we can all understand what's on our collective minds and get a better picture of who we are as a country right now.
Well, the title 1A is a nod to the First Amendment, which right. seems to be increasingly under attack these days. Do you feel this is simply a moment in time, or do you expect that to continue?
Well, attacks on freedom of the press have existed since before we were a country. I mean, the whole John Peter Zenger case that kind of got this idea percolating that maybe this is one of those things that we should enshrine somewhere, all the way up to now. I mean, America's first daily newspaper, Public Occurrences, published for a day, one day, because it criticized the wrong government official, and boop, out it went. This idea that, you know, we kill the messenger is not new. I think that technology changes the game because we're all messengers and you can't take us all out. And that's one of the things that we build on with 1A, that everyone has the capacity to speak up. What we're trying to do is use that capacity to make it easier for you to be heard by the nation. I mean, the idea that you could attack the First Amendment, well, okay, fine, but the very fact that these rights are enshrined means that they need protecting. So I'm not surprised by the attack. We knew that these attacks would come. It's up to us to make sure that we use these rights so that we don't lose these rights.
Now, take us through a typical day as you prepare for your show. What are you reading? Who are you listening to? And how do you determine what you are going to focus on a particular broadcast before you get that listener feedback?
Well, first of all, I live in Washington, so there's no such thing as a typical day. Those don't really exist anymore, I think. Every day is a little bit different, which is kind of part of what makes the show fun to do. But generally speaking, we meet in the morning around 8 a.m. Eastern, talk about that day's shows. We think through what the next day's shows are going to be, particularly if we haven't figured out what one of the hours is going to be. We'll brainstorm on that. The show is live from 10 to noon Eastern, and then we get to work on whatever else is coming down the pike, whether it's trying to book a guest for an upcoming interview, whether we have an idea for a show that we want to flesh out a little more, whether it's an author and we're working our way through a book, if it's the Friday News Roundup, figuring out what the topics might be and who the panelists are, or if it's a trip that we're taking to, say, visit another station, figuring out how that's going to go and what topics we might do when we get there and what events we'd be part of. It's always a little bit different. The work of building something like this is never dull and it's never rote, which is kind of nice. That means that we're building something new and we're breaking some ground. So there's a routine to it, but there's not really, you know, a typicality to it, which is good.
And I'm sure it has to be fluid by the nature of what we do, which, as you said, is part of the excitement of it.
Yeah, we have no problem kind of changing the flow of the show to get in a news story. We're not a breaking news program per se, but if something is big and we want to talk about it, one of the good things about Washington is that there are people here to talk about just about everything. So we can take what would have been a 3-segment discussion on a topic and squish it down to 2. And then make the first segment, the A segment, about the news of the day. So we try to be flexible, but we don't chase headlines the way you might on cable news. We'd rather, and we will often, wait to do a breaking story until the next day when it's evolved a little bit more and when folks like you and I might have a little more to say about it from a place of knowledge as opposed to just a knee-jerk reaction.
The hot take that's become right. popular in media.
And there's so much of that. Like, why would we come on the air and do something that there's so much of already? We're trying to do something new.
Joshua Johnson is host of the NPR program 1A here on GLT, weekday mornings from 9 to 11. Joshua, who are your influencers who guide you as a broadcaster and as a journalist?
Well, when I was growing up, I wanted to be kind of the amalgamation of three people who were influential to me as a child of the 80s. I wanted to be somewhere at the intersection of Bernard Shaw, Arsenio Hall, and Oprah Winfrey. Like, that was my perfect center of what I wanted to be.
How close are you to those three now?
I don't know. That's debatable. Hopefully I'm getting closer. But, you know, I still don't have my mansion on the coast in Montecito, so I'm definitely not Oprah. But I always loved how Bernard Shaw from CNN just had this reputation of being unimpeachable. When he spoke, you could just trust what he said. And he was reliable and solid to a wide array of people, regardless of their politics. I loved how Arsenio Hall was doing the next big thing. You know, you would appear on Johnny Carson when you had arrived. You appeared on Arsenio Hall when you were taking off. And I like to be on the cutting edge of where things might be going. And then I loved Oprah's ubiquity. She could do anything, go anywhere, talk to anybody. And when someone went on the Oprah Winfrey Show, it was the canonical conversation with that person about that thing. And that's kind of what I loved. I wanted to be in something journalistic that was reliable, that was solid, that was trustworthy, that didn't depend on you agreeing with me in advance politically. I wanted to do something that was cutting edge, and I wanted to do something that was for everybody. Not something that's so bland that it offends nobody, but something that is so welcoming and expansive that it can open its arms to everybody.
Just promise us you're not moving to late night anytime soon.
You know, well, there are some stations who do air 1A in the late night hours. We have a few stations that can do that. But in terms of like an audience and a band and sketches and jokes and cue cards, I doubt that very highly.
You can do all that. You can do all that yourself.
You never know.
For those who are new to public radio, perhaps new because of your show, explain what it means to you and why you feel listeners need to play a role in keeping public radio thriving, especially at a fun drive time like this.
Well, it's a very different relationship that we have with our audience than commercial media have. And I'm not knocking commercial media, but it's just very different. I mean, I used to work for the station in San Francisco before I got this job. I was their morning newscaster. And I remember occasionally I'd screw something up on the air and a listener would call to complain, as they should. And so, you know, I would pick up the phone, KQED News, this is Joshua.
Hey, I got a bone to pick with you. I heard that your program and that guy, whoever he is, he said such a thing. Can I talk to somebody? That guy, Joshua Johnson, can I talk to somebody about him? I don't know about that guy.
And I would say, this is Joshua, can I help you? And the other person would be like,
you're Joshua Johnson?
Yes, this is Joshua. What seems to be the problem?
Oh,
well, first of all, I love your show. Don't get me wrong. That's the first thing I want you to know. The whole tone shifted because they expected to get what they get from everybody else. How often do you call customer support and you get no support as a customer? Good luck calling CNN and complaining about what you heard Anderson Cooper say. But if you call GLT and ask for someone to talk to you about what you heard, someone will. Because we are literally here because you made us happen. Those other news organizations exist because someone with enough deep pockets said, I willed this into existence. But you willed this into existence. Like, communities built NPR. 90 stations got together in 1970 and launched the organization. That's why All Things Considered debuted in 1971. It's a community effort, and so people feel a very different affinity for an organization that has to be accountable instead of an organization that chooses to be accountable. We have no choice but to be accountable to you, because if we're not, we disappear instantly. There's nowhere else for us to go, but there's nowhere else that we should go. The problem with that, the challenge with that, is that we're relying on you, that you have to step up. And if you don't,
There's no way that we can continue to provide the kind of journalism we provide. People think about, oh, Congress and all this money through the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I got news for you. A lot of stations across the country get about half of their support from listeners like you, even in major markets. I think Dr. Seuss summed it up way better than I possibly could with a line from The End of the Lorax. Unless someone like you cares a whole awful lot, nothing is going to get better. It's not.
Joshua Johnson's program, 1A, airs weekday mornings from 9 to 11 here on GLT. He spoke with GLT's Eric Stock. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Eric Stock. WGLT.org is the first place to go to subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast. Also look for it at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of the show. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Tweet us your comments using the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News, and I'm at Ryan WGLT. You just heard from Joshua Johnson from 1A talking to GLT about Fun Drive. It is Fun Drive time here at GLT. Right now, we're especially looking for new GLT contributors, people who care about the community, people who value unbiased reporting, people who understand GLT's independent news coverage and quality entertainment depend on listeners' financial support. Your first-time contribution right now is a powerful gesture. It means you're willing to stand up, be counted as someone who believes in public media enough to make it possible. Support the programs you depend on and help us meet this week's Fun Drive goal. Become a GLT contributor now at WGLT.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.